Hello and welcome to Zing Talk, where Ben Zinga brings you the biggest names and brightest minds from Silicon Valley to New York City. Today our guest is Andrew Ross Sorkin, a journalist and columnist for the New York Times, as well as the founder and editor of DealBook. How are you doing today, Andrew?
Great to be here. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Could you start off by telling us a little bit about your role at the New York Times and DealBook?
I have a couple roles in the New York Times. I'm a columnist. I started originally as a mergers and acquisitions reporter and then started a little mini business, if you will, called DealBook, which started as a daily email and has now grown to be a full-fledged website. And we actually have a mobile app and a whole host of other products.
Now, it's no hiding the fact that you're one of the youngest people around cited as an authority on Wall Street, economics, mergers and acquisitions, et cetera, and it's in a leadership position as such a major media outlet. Could you talk a little bit about the rapid ascension and what you think brought you to where you are today?
Oh, that's such a hard question to ask and look even remotely humble. You know, I started here when I was 18 years old as an intern, if you will. I wasn't even really part of the internship program, and used to Xerox and staple for a guy named Stuart Elliott, who was the advertising columnist. And when I got here, I had no intention of putting two words together, let alone a sentence, and got lucky very early on. An editor who didn't know how old I was, I was in the building, had a suit on, thought I must be doing something right, assigned me a story to write. And she didn't realize at the time, I think, that I was still in high school. So, I've been doing this now for... now way over a decade, and when I graduated from school, I went to Cornell University. When I graduated, moved over to London, and the New York Times gave me a job out there where I covered mergers and acquisitions, really at the height of the M&A bubble. This is now 1999. Time Warner's buying AOL, Vivendi buying Seagram's, if you remember that. Vodafone bought management for $183 billion. I don't think we've ever seen another merger that's come close in terms of size. So it was really a trial by fire and a remarkable education. And then I moved back to the States in 2001, I want to say. And one of the first things I did when I got back here, and I was going to continue covering mergers at M&A for the paper, was to start this thing called DealBook, which was an email that I used to send literally at 7 o'clock in the morning. I'd wake up at 5 in the morning out to all the people in the deal community, the bankers, the lawyers, the hedge fund managers, the accountants, some CEOs and board members, et cetera. And it really, just grew. I remember the first year we thought maybe we could get to 30,000 readers, and I think we got to 80,000 today. We have about over 200,000 people who get the email every morning, but now we have a website with 2+ million people on it. So it's been a remarkable little ride over the past couple of years.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like it. And I also want to talk to you a little bit about your book that just came out fairly recently, Too Big to Fail, How Wall Street and Washington Fought to Save the Financial System and Themselves. Now, it's truly incredible that you were able to chronicle the sorts of dealings in the financial sector in the way that you did. Can you tell us a little bit about how you were able to do that? How did you get that kind of access?
Well, I decided to write this book almost within the week or two of when Lehman Brothers failed in the fall of 2008. My wife was actually the one who said, Andrew, if you're ever going to write a book, this is the book to write. And in many ways, I think I was probably well-suited to do it, even though I didn't think I personally could have done it at the time. I was sort of nervous that I could even pull it off. But, having covered Wall Street for over a decade at that point, I knew a lot of people on the street. I didn't actually know as many of the main characters as I think some readers probably imagine I did. But I was able to, I think through sort of old school traditional shoe leather reporting, getting in front of a lot of the right people, asking questions, getting people to tell me stuff they weren't supposed to say. And one of the great things that happens as you're reporting is, the more people you talk to, the more information you have. You can then go back to the people that don't want to talk to you. So I always say to people, about a third of the people, I think, spoke to me for the right reasons. They thought this was a sense of history. They were willing to be part of it. They wanted to be helpful. and I actually had a CEO very early on in the process of doing the interviews, actually came to me and handed me his notes, physical notes from his weekend down at the Federal Reserve that weekend that Lehman Brothers failed. And I said to him, why are you giving me these notes? And he said, because, for the same reason I took them, because I thought, you know, this was history in the making. I always say another third of the people probably talked to me for all the wrong reasons, which is, you know, the sense that they wanted to, you know, resurrect their legacy and rewrite history, and you know, of course my job was to keep them honest. But one of the interesting things that happens is once you talk to the first two thirds, you know, that last third, which is typically the group that doesn't want to talk to you, and remember, as I was writing this book, there was nobody, you know, there was all sorts of internal investigations, civil litigation, potential criminal litigation. There were people who had reason not to talk. But I think what happens is once you end up talking to the first two thirds, the other third decides, oh my goodness, this guy's actually talked to a lot of people. He's done a lot of work. Maybe I need to actually sit down with him. So the example I always give is there was an executive who I'd been trying to get forever to talk to me, didn't want to talk to me. The lawyer wouldn't let him talk to me. Nobody would, you know, went on and on and on. And then finally I got him on the phone, and I said, I know you don't want to talk to me. He says, yes, I don't want to talk to you. And I said, well, at least let me tell you what I have. And he said, sure, but it's not going to change my mind. And I said, well, I have you in a scene, actually, at John Mack's house. I think it was July 11th, or July 12th or 13th. It's a Saturday morning. You're sitting on the couch. It's a green couch on the right-hand side. You're eating this chicken wrap sandwich, you know, blah, 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 blah. Exactly what he said. And he said, you know, I didn't think I wanted to talk to you, but maybe I should now. So I think that's, you know, that was sort of the process. But over time, you know, some of it was foreign documents. Some of it was finding people who would give me documents. So many of these people liked each other, but so many of them also disliked each other. So it was about trying to find the mole who would tell you different things, and then going back to confirm it and reconfirm it. And, you know, in a scene where you might have 8 to 10 people, if I could have talked to 8 of the 10 people, or 9 of the 10 people, or even 10 of the 10 people, you can really get a good sense of what really happened. And then you can hold each person's feet to the fire in terms of the quotes to make sure that they're actually, you know, that's exactly what they said.
Now, could you highlight some of the most interesting experiences, in your opinion, that you write about in the book for our listeners?
You know, I thought I think there were a couple big revelations for me. The first was the sense that the TARP plan, the original plan to buy up $700 billion of toxic assets, which was announced in September of 2008 after Lehman Brothers went under, was really written, not in September 2008 at all, but back in April, that the government actually saw this train barreling down the track and actually had written up an 11-page memo about what to do. And it was called Break the Glass, as in an emergency, break the glass. And, you know, that I thought was a revelation. I remember doing some reporting and finding out that Hank Paulson, there had always been these questions about Hank Paulson and Goldman Sachs, that Hank Paulson had actually held a meeting with the board of Goldman Sachs in Russia, of all things, in June of 2008 at night in his own hotel suite. And I remember being somewhat shocked that something like that could happen. It almost seemed unbelievable to me. And then the real revelation, more than anything else, was frankly just how bad things really were in September 2008. I mean, I thought it was bad just looking at the tape every day and the stories I was writing and the stories my colleagues were writing, but when you really get in the room and get behind the scenes, it was worse. You know, there was a real sense of panic that this whole thing was going to go bust. That, you know, we were talking about not 10% unemployment like we have now, but 25% unemployment. That Morgan Stanley was on the verge of bankruptcy, that Goldman Sachs was on the verge of bankruptcy, that there was worries that General Electric was going to go bankrupt. And so it's that sort of sense of panic that I think was really a shock. And as a merger guy, an M&A guy, I was also surprised at just the role of government and sort of how the invisible hand became much more visible and how, in fact, Tim Geithner and Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke were trying to orchestrate deals. I didn't know at the time that they tried to put Goldman Sachs and Citigroup together, for example, or Morgan Stanley and J.P. Morgan together. I mean, these things were, I wish I had been able to report them and knew about them contemporaneously at the time, but that, I think those were the big surprises.
Did that shake, in a sense, your belief in government or change the way that you look at politics, for example?
I think it did. I think I didn't appreciate what the government was doing behind the scenes. And this was a particularly aggressive government, and I think this particular group took their jobs not just seriously, but almost took a different approach than other politicians and other regulators might. I think in part because Hank Paulson was a former dealmaker and a former CEO on Wall Street, this was sort of, government by deal in a way. It was a different approach. And I think that there was so much effort by the government at the time to at least appear as if the free markets were working as free markets. And so I think that was sort of the shock for me, that it wasn't as free as I thought.
And the book was actually just optioned recently by HBO for a film. Are you getting ready to show the world that you can act in addition to being a superb writer?
It's very exciting. They are pursuing the film, and it's been very interesting. They just hired William Hurt to play Hank Paulson. But no, I don't have a. I've seen at least one draft of the script thus far, and I don't have a role in it. There's no character called Andrew Ross Sorkin. So I will be a spectator like everybody else.
Are you planning on contributing behind the scenes to the film or anything of that nature?
I'm a consulting producer, so I participate in various conference calls, and I talk often with the writer, the screenwriter, and the producers and director, and they call for different suggestions and dialogue and really questions around accuracy and things like that. So it's been a great education and very exciting for someone like me who hasn't really ever been involved in Hollywood to at least get a sneak peek into it all.
And how's it look so far? Does it look like it's going to be a blockbuster?
I think it's going to be great. I think they're actually doing a really good job of it. They're still in the middle of casting, and they want to get into production. I think this fall it could slip through the spring. I don't know what the plan ultimately will be. But, yeah, I think it could make a great movie. When I wrote the book, I think just because the way my is sort of wired, I wrote it not necessarily thinking about it to be a film in the future, but I wanted it to be a scene-driven book. The best business books I had ever read, like Barbarians at the Gate or Den of Thieves, really put you, the reader, in the middle of the action, in the middle of the scene, and that's what I really wanted to do with Too Big to Fail. And so to the extent that translates well, hopefully, at least, into an actual film, it'd be great.
I want to talk to you a little bit more about DealBook. It was really one of the first sites of its kind when it started. What prompted the idea of how you took that site? After you started doing the email, the newsletter, how did you take that into making it a website of its own?
Well, I think, the two things happened, and it really actually goes back to the email, which was when we first started the email, it was really around how can we get in front of this community. We have this great thing called the New York Times as a newspaper, which really gets in front of a lot of people, but we really wanted to truly get in front of them to make sure that the people were really reading every last thing. And the other thing was I was spending an inordinate amount of time just as a young person fooling around the Internet every day looking and finding stories, and I figured lots of other people were probably wasting time doing that too, so I thought if we could basically aggregate stories, this is sort of pre-aggregation of blogs, that would have a real, be a really great service. And at the same time, we could also use it to get in front of the right people and at the same time be able to show off what we thought was our great competitive content. So that's how it developed. And then over time, as we created this really amazing audience that was subscribing to the email, I mean, if you were to look through the list of recipients, it's all gs.com, ms.com, VFA.com, Treasury.gov, WhiteHouse.gov. It's remarkable. The big issue was how do we take that audience, which was really having that touch point with us only once a day. They were using the email sort of in that morning as a sort of as a tip sheet. How could we migrate and create a sort of tighter relationship with that community? And that's really where the website came in, trying to provide sort of real-time analysis throughout the day so that they weren't just you know, touching base with us once a morning to see what was going on, but they were actually coming back throughout the day to see what others are writing, because we were still doing a lot of aggregation, and to see what type of original analysis we had on top of that. And that's what we're doing today, and we're trying to actually do a lot more of it. So.
Now, with DealBooker separately, what was the most interesting story you've ever covered as a reporter for the New York Times, and why?
That's a great question. The most interesting story I ever covered for the New York Times, and why? I'll give you two, and neither have to do with business, if you can believe that. I'll give you three. The most interesting business story I ever covered by a mile, actually, was the Vodafone management hostile takeover for $183 billion. And it was just this, it was a hostile deal, and it went on for 6 months, and I'd be flying from London to Düsseldorf in Germany, and it was just, it was a transformational deal in so many respects. The characters were larger than life. It was one of those sort of over-the-top, sort of amazing moments in time. But the two actual stories that, to me, I thought were actually most interesting in an odd way was I must have been only 21 years old, I think, I was working the London Bureau down to Cornwall, England, where the eclipse, the last eclipse of the millennium, was going to take place. They normally didn't send a business report of this, but they were sort of out of people, so they sent me down there. And all these people from around the world had gone to this one location in England because it was going to be the best location to see the eclipse. And I got there, and it rained, and so nobody could see the eclipse, and they said, you still have to write a story. And so I went around and spoke to all of the people there who had traveled for like days about this horrible experience. And I actually, it's one of my favorite stories of all time. But the other sort of truly favorite story I have was when I was, let's say 19, I was still, you know, it was still at Cornell, and I desperately wanted to go see the Rolling Stones in concert. So I pitched a story to the New York Times, if you can believe this, about the technology behind the Rolling Stones and their concert series, because back then they were like the only ones doing these sort of massive computer-powered tours, if you will. And I ended up traveling with the band and going behind the stages and doing all this stuff, and I was probably 19 years old, and it was that was one of the cooler things. But I've covered a lot of the financial crisis was, I don't want to say it was cool, it was depressing, but it was one of the most interesting things I've ever seen. Dennis Kozlowski's trial, both of his trials, was fascinating to me. So it's been, if you had ever asked me if I would have had the opportunity to do any of these things when I was a kid, I'm still pinching myself now.
So in other words, Hank Paulson, he doesn't have anything on the Rolling Stones.
You know, Hank Paulson he's no Mick Jagger, at least not yet. But I shouldn't say that, actually. In truth of everything I've had the opportunity to do, building DealBook, writing for the paper, television things, all sorts of things, the book unto itself, I think, was probably actually the most challenging, intellectually challenging, probably the most interesting sort of three-dimensional puzzle that I'd ever put together, and just the challenge of doing it and the time that I had to do it and really trying to capture the moments. That, I don't think I'll ever... I hope I have other great challenges like it, but it's one that stands out that, I worry I won't be able to beat.
All right, well, right now we're giving you the loudspeaker now to break any piece of news or put out any opinion you feel is not getting enough attention or hasn't been sufficiently reported.
Something that hasn't been sufficiently reported. I mean, there's two things to me that haven't been sufficiently reported, but these aren't really business issues per se. It's really about what's happened to the country in the past year or two, and the civility or lack of civility that I think has really transformed the conversation, and frankly, it's transforming the business conversation. And it's become so personal. I mean, this is sort of very meta, I guess, but you know, when I look at a lot of the Wall Street titans, many of whom supported President Obama, for example, and you know, now, of course, so many of them have turned on him, and you try to understand why, it actually, to me, has less to do with policy changes or legislation or anything like that, but it's about the personal nature of the rhetoric. It's around the sense that the president has, you know, called them fat cats and that they've been vilified in the press and this and that. And I'm not suggesting that they shouldn't be considered those things, but I do think, and this is not a defense of Wall Street at all, but it's a larger issue around how we're all dealing with each other and how, in terms of the adult conversation that we need to have broadly about everything, is that I worry it's devolved. I don't remember it being at this sort of very base level when I first started writing for this paper, and it's something that worries me, irrespective of, you know, its implications on business, but just our sort of larger picture. And on the issues, by the way, the thing that I really think we need to focus on, it's a story that's been told over and over again, but I still think people don't pay enough attention to it because it seems so down the road, is I'm a bit of a debt hawk. When I think about Too Big to Fail, when I wrote the book, it was about financial institutions today. I think about it in the context of states like California and countries like Greece. And at some point, the rubber's going to meet the road. And, you know, you think about what happened with Lehman Brothers. At some point, the confidence got sucked out of the system. At some point, banks that used to trade with Lehman Brothers decided they were no longer good for the money and wouldn't trade with them anymore. And at some point, I'm worried that that's what's going to happen on a much grander scale to states like California, as I said, or to countries, or to our country eventually. And that's a story that I think we got to keep front and center.
And do you think that, going back to the lack of civility, do you think that might have anything to do with the rise of the Tea Party movement and other movements like it?
Yeah, I don't know if it's about politics or about parties or ideology or so much as I think it probably has to do a lot with the media. I think it has a lot to do, not necessarily with the media itself, but even just the medium, the internet, the ability to give voice, to give everyone a megaphone. And in this cacophony, there's a sense that you got to get louder. You got to fight through the noise. And how do you do that? And how do you get people's attention? And unfortunately, oftentimes, the easiest way to get people's attention is to go to the sort of least common denominator. And that's what I think happened during this period, more than anything else.
All right, now that we've got the hard questions out of the way, so to speak, we have just a few more lighthearted ones we ask all our first-time guests. What was your first and what was your worst job?
Oh, that's so hard for me because my first job was at the New York Times.
There you go.
I haven't truly had an opportunity to have a worse job because I love my job. You know, I never liked shoveling snow, so maybe that would count, but I have been remarkably blessed in ways that I can't even begin to describe. So I can't even say I had, you know, most of my friends, most of them I know have had a job that you could describe as being, you know, bad or maybe not the worst, but I really haven't. It's knock on wood, I've been lucky.
All right, tell us something about yourself that no one's asked you about in an interview before.
No one's asked me about in an interview before. Nobody ever asks me about my mother. I often get asked about my father because people think of my father is either Aaron Sorkin, the screenwriter, who he's not, or they think he's Ira Lee Sorkin, who was the lawyer for Madoff, who he's not either. I get that question a lot, but no one ever says, who's your mother? And so the answer to that is that my mother's a woman named Joan Ross Sorkin. Ross is... and she's actually a playwright, and so I've always thought that some of my writing, I don't know if I have writing chops, but if I had writing chops, or my interest in dialogue or narrative or sort of story structure probably is a function of her.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Do you have a hero?
Do I have a hero? I probably do, but I probably can't think of it. It's one of those things that if you ask me this in a half hour from now, I'm sure I'd probably give you the person I think about all the time. I always want, as a child, wanted as a job to be Brandon Tartikoff, who was the head of NBC, and he was in charge of programming. I always thought that I wanted to program a TV network. I don't know if he was my hero, but he was somebody that I remember very much looking after. He died, unfortunately, but he was an interesting, very, very interesting guy.
All right, this last question is Benzinga's trademark question. What was the best and what was the worst investment decision that you've ever made?
Oh, well, that's actually a hard one for me because I'm actually not allowed to, given my job, invest in individual stocks. So,
right.
That's
even from a personal standpoint, we've had people.
Well, I would say from an investment standpoint, my best decision was actually I did own some mutual funds and I took them out actually in September of 2008. So that was actually quite brilliant actually. But I was stupid enough not to do anything with them afterwards, so that I missed whatever train already left the station.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming on this episode of Zing Talk, Andrew. That'll do it. Remember to check out the latest market-moving information, commentary, and trading ideas on www.benzinga.com.
Hey, Andrew, that was great. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Be sure to subscribe in iTunes. You can find a link to do that right off of the Benzinga homepage. The music that you're listening to is Beethoven Virus by Banya and is available on the Internet Archive. All Benzinga podcasts are released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.5 license, and all other rights are reserved.